So Advent is calendarized to coincide with the final countdown to the darkest day of the year. And from the earliest times in Christianity, celebrating the birth of Christ and the weeks leading up to that celebration has been understood as a time to speak at the time of the greatest natural darkness to the condition of spiritual darkness, one that God addressed with a new and a deeper coming of the divine into human hearts and human minds with the advent of Jesus' life and work. Both of our scripture lections refer to ominous times in which a darkness covers the spiritual collective unconscious, if you will. Isaiah, prophesying about a half a millennium before Christ, traditionally has been interpreted by Christians as referring to a coming light that will speak to a darkness that has fallen across people. But in our gospel lection, Jesus is now the speaker, and he speaks about a yet new darkness, another second advent. In the verses immediately preceding our lection, he employs the metaphor of darkness and suggests that often people do not have a clue, as what we read, about being in any kind of strange time. That times are ominous. People are going around living regular lives with no clue about the bigger picture. We live in a culture and a time in a lot of ways that greatly perplex me. I'm not a prophet, and I have no call or vision to declare a cultural darkness in my living, my times. But I do wonder how enlightened our modern world is in its sophisticated trending, yet towards more rounds of declaring the death of God. The massive landmark Pew study on religion in America that was completed last year, the largest sociological study of religion in America in over a decade, confirmed that the fastest growing category of belief in our culture is no belief. Or, if you will, a belief that there is nothing to believe in beyond whatever sense and meaning you want to make in your ride through this biological life that has arisen without purpose in a random and chaotic natural universe. The three most commonly cited reasons for not believing in any kind of higher intelligent life are a perception that science has actually disproven the claims of religion, and secondly, a conviction that the extent of evil does not square with and cannot justify a loving God, and thirdly, a perception that they've had no personal experience of anything that could be called God. I want to reflect upon that first one, the perception that science has disproven religion, as I think that this somewhat intense conversation in our culture today is a version of asking about whether we are in the dark about why we are here. A persistent challenge from the realm of science has questioned the fundamentals of whether the creation itself shows any signs at all of a creator. There's a lot of buzz today about what is called the new atheism, with such leading exponents as Bill Maher in the popular media, Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and as cultural critics, and such academic philosophers of science as Daniel Dennett at Tufts, and especially Richard Dawkins, who's the professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford. Of Dawkins' several influential books, the one that has struck the deepest chord is The God Delusion. The nub of Dawkins' argument against the existence of God is that a higher intelligent force, or God, as an explanation for life, is too mathematically improbable. And the sequence of his thinking runs like this. The amazing thing is that there's scarcely a competent scientist, a physicist today, who does not agree that the fact that we are sitting here with our properties is extremely improbable. Extremely improbable. Representing the level of organized complexity that we are is an astounding outcome for a random bottom-up universe. Given the basic controlling conditions of the cosmos set in those first nanoseconds after the Big Bang, Dawkins rolls out the famous ultimate Boeing 747 gambit metaphor to frame the situation. The mathematical probability of our complex life structures arising from chance is less likely than the probability of a hurricane roaring through a scrap metal junkyard, picking up a whole chaos of materials, carrying them along, and then setting down at the end of the hurricane's trail a completely manufactured Boeing 747. So, that makes Dawkins sound as if he agrees that a purposeless universe can't be the answer, right? Natural philosophy theists since Swedenborg's century have argued that there has to be a purposeful design mechanism set within the basic informational structure of the cosmos in order for all of these extreme improbabilities to work out in such a way that life as we know it happened and is happening. And Dawkins believes that this is, in fact, the very best argument that religionists have. It's the very best argument for the existence of God. But it's flawed. It's fatally flawed, in his opinion, due to the fact that all it does is push the improbability stretch up another notch in the food chain. Now you have to account for how that supra-organized complexity being force exists in the first place. How did it come into being? So it is a path of an ad nauseum reductionism, and it isn't the answer. He thinks Christians are still quite in the dark with their God hypothesis, and his reasoning is very appealing, isn't it, in some ways? It certainly is appealing to an increasingly large group of people. Now, Swedenborg was a celebrated natural scientist who believed empirical science to be a classic case of half-empty, half-full subjectivity. That looking at nature for evidence of God is impossibly subjective. Attitude and perspective have so much to do with what we think we are finding. In the science and theology realm of discourse, which is one of my favorites, you can always see those committed to skepticism feeling emboldened by every advance in science as proof that we're figuring it out step by step on our way. At the same time, those quite emotionally committed to belief see that all possibilities with every new discovery of what an amazing universe God is advancing. Swedenborg saw this happening in his century, which is famously identified as the coming of age science century. Those inclined to dismiss God can easily construct arguments, he said, from the data for a negative prognosis. And if one wants to see God in nature's workings, there will be an infinite number of confirming details that something special and intentional is afoot in this whole universe. Importantly, Swedenborg claimed that such ambiguity is critical for our spiritual growth. It's important that there is no proof either for or against a higher purpose in the creation. If God suddenly, with a great bam and smoke and mirrors, came into the sanctuary right now and looked at each one of us in our face and into our deep heart, we would have no chance not to respond in belief, not to have our whole life become committed to a certain reality that has been overwhelmingly made manifest to us. We would not have any way of being grounded in our personal choice making for taking steps of strenuous effort towards a spiritual wholeness that we would seek, but rather would be doing it out of a sense of obedience to an overwhelming force. Can you feel the difference in the basis of your decisionings in those two situations, those two rooms? A room like this one, where we see beauty, music, all kinds of arcs towards the Spirit, and yet, no, it's not a test tube proof case. Or one in which we have a giant being presence completely overwhelming our own existence and running around doing as great a job as we can with the chores that we've been assigned. We are left in a condition of life such that we are never compelled or forced to believe anything. Swedenborg speaks about that very explicitly. Not even slightly. Authentic spiritual growth has to be chosen in a state of freedom. And our freedom to go one way or another without apparent external punishment is the pivot upon which our soul does its work. Now, Alvin Plantinga, a philosopher at Notre Dame, perhaps the premier analytical philosopher of religion in the U.S., is widely regarded as having the most effective counter to Dawkins's complexity argument. And interestingly, it aligns closely with Swedenborg's spiritual philosophy. In a nutshell, Plantinga argues that the God which Christianity has posed historically is simple, not complex, is a simple order of reality, not a highly complex one like Avatar or Star Wars. God is simple in the sense that within God's essential being, there is no distinction between thing and property, actuality and potentiality, essence and existence. No distinctions at all. Just the ground of being. And Swedenborg, in his most philosophical of his theological works, which is called Divine Love and Wisdom, discusses God in a similar way. Complexity only emerges with manifestation as the creating divine animates expressions of life in its emanations outward. But in its essence, God is simple and whole. Dawkins is assuming that God would have to be like the organized complexity of this world, but only a whole lot more so. But Swedenborg and Plantinga are saying, no, God is an utter simplicity that cannot be defined by or compared to parameters of organized complexity in physics. More than anything else, God is maybe like the sun, radiating love that itself brings innumerable distinctive manifestations in its light. It is the distinction between spiritual and natural. And you and I have that same distinction too, of a simple place of who we are and a very complex body that walks around and moves and carries it. Our soul, the spiritual part of us, is in fact akin to a simple substance. Though our brain and our body are extremely complex, the fact that a simple force can mediate through a complex operation, according to Plantinga and Swedenborg, indicates that Dawkins doesn't understand the nature of God or of spirit and doesn't understand what religion is saying about the creative force behind the external complexities of the material universe. Okay. A little philosophy there. Let's tie in Advent. Swedenborg says further that the incarnational life of God as Christ was part of a spiritual evolution in the way that an even more potent connection to the divine source was developed in the consciousness structures of humanity and of the heavens. Swedenborg called this even more direct relationship to the divine immediate influx. He claims it came into the world through Mary with Jesus. A human channel now, a human divine channel that allows us sort of a spiritual advanced place as evolving beings in which to have a direct simple substance to simple substance relationship with God and the divine flowing into us. When we turn our attention inwardly to the presence of God, understanding that we are turning toward a presence that is more like a person than anything else we can understand analogically, a deeply personal and relational source of love and light, we shift consciousness-wise towards that light, a receptivity towards that light, and connect and become connected with a flowing channel that puts us more directly into the path flow of love and light. How might that work? You can call this practicing the presence of the light. Practicing the presence of God. Practicing the presence of love. In all things is learning to turn inward to the divine simple. The divine that can so powerfully emanate into our spiritual inmost. This inward turn is something that we can do often, continually, all day long, and get better and better at it as we develop the feel for it, just like in skiing or in bicycle riding or in playing tennis, a feel for what it means to go inwardly and face the divine flow that is always mediating towards us and can immediately move into us if we relate to it. So, for instance, take something small and commonplace. Someone behaves selfishly in traffic, creates a little problem for us. Our temper flares. In our spiritual discipline, we can reflexively turn towards the divine in our inmost. It can be instantaneous. We immediately begin to feel ourselves shift. As soon as we consciously do that, there's a shift, and we adjust into a higher view of what's going on. A more mature and wise perspective. Or it might be something more difficult, such as when we notice that we're being drawn into a feeling of conflict with someone with whom disharmony seems to arise often. In our spiritual discipline, we can practice the presence of turning to the spiritual core, the light that is at the core of our being. When you do that, there's always a shift. One doesn't have to stay with that. One might snap back out of that and keep persisting in another pattern. But how many of us are not aware of what it means to turn inwardly, honestly, towards God and feel an immediate shift? So, this sounds not particularly revolutionary, does it? It's not revolutionary. It's been spoken about in so many faith traditions for thousands of years. Many non-theists believe in the powers of balance and peace with inward psychological training, meditation, certain exercises. The only difference might be in imagining what grounds, what centers and transforms us. And maybe it doesn't really matter. Maybe it's too big of a question to answer. But nonetheless, Christianity and Swedenborgianism point to a really big story about this, a really big story unfolding in this universe and in this season of Advent, a story that is extraordinarily vast and complex, but also very simple and very basic. Here we are on this amazing orb of organized complexity, swirling towards the darkest time of the year. Are we in the dark about why we are here and where we are going? Or are we in the light, seeing the one who comes to us, who's always here with us, forever?